Yeah, okay, there we are. All right, well, we're running a little late today, but as I have mentioned previously, we are now into what is mostly a very straightforward historical presentation about the life of Paul in these last couple of years that are going to be covered by the latter chapters of the book of Acts. And so we finished up essentially the third journey last week there at verse 7 when it says, we had finished the voyage from Tyre, we arrived at Ptolemais, and after greeting the brethren, stayed with them for a day. And on the next day we departed and came to Caesarea, and entering the house of Philip the evangelist, who was one of the seven, we stayed with him. So we've been on Paul's longest journey. He's been out 4 to 5 years. He spent 3 years just in the city of Ephesus. But then as he got to Corinth and turned around to retrace his steps, he was in a hurry to get to Jerusalem in time for the Passover, and so he came to the port of Miletus, sent up for the elders from Ephesus, and he spent the 20th chapter with Paul addressing those elders, warning them about hard times that were going to come, about apostasy that was going to assail that church, savage wolves would enter in among them. So Paul was preparing them, not just for the work that they had to do, but as you recall, it was also a very emotional moment because Paul informed those people that they would not be seeing him again. So we've had inklings of times where Paul is communicating with God rather communicating with him. Various prophets have spoken to him, or else he himself has received the message. And so he knows that bonds await him when he gets down here to Jerusalem. On more than one occasion, they've tried to dissuade him from going. The prophet says this is going to happen, but the prophet is not saying don't go. He's just saying this is going to happen. The people around Paul are presuming, well, then maybe that's a warning and you shouldn't go. And so they would suggest that he not go. Paul understood this to be required and necessary. So there's no conflict. When you see the prophet says this, people are arguing against it. But Paul recognizes, no, I have to go, and you'll see that again. And so he now has sailed on down here, first to Tyre, north of Israel, short hop down the coast again to Ptolemais, modern Acro, I think they call it, or Haifa, and then to Caesarea Maritima, which is right here on the coast. Now, of course, from time to time, I've had occasion to mention Caesarea. It's already come up. You know, Cornelius was converted there. This is truly a magnificent site, one of the by far most enjoyable places to visit in Israel. This aerial shot, I've flown over it twice now, taking photographs. You know, it shows the rubble in the dark areas that is 2 millenniums now of what once were enormously ornate, expensive, and imposing structures that have succumbed to the ravages of time now, finally. And so the darker waters that you see are the remains of those walls and those structures. Now, there's actually a little dive shop right here. You know, on my last trip, I went in and spoke with him for a little while, and I got in the water, and I swam all around through all of this, spent an hour in the water, and was able to see, they give you a little map to use, various remnants from the original constructions that Herod the Great had created so long ago. And so whether you're, you know, above ground or below water, it's just a magnificent thing to see. Now, you're familiar with a very extensive site that is Caesarea Maritima, stretching from here all the way out of sight. But also, it would have filled in all this area that is now agricultural land. There's a little museum right back in here that I visited, and these people owned Sadaim, I think it's the name of the kibbutz. And they owned all of this land going back to the 1800s, and then as they began plowing it, one artifact after another came to light. And so what we've been learning in these last 150 years, I guess, is that this extensive port had, you know, a straight line beach like most of Israel is, and so Herod had built elaborate harbors, actually a total of 3 harbors. And in this artist illustration, this line that you see right here, I believe you'll be able to see in the next photograph if I line those up yet. Yes. Okay, so today, this area here has been filled in, but the water used to go all the way back to that line right there. So when it says that Paul came to Caesarea, in all likelihood, he came into these waters and would have tied up at docks that were all along the side here, or perhaps the ship would have gone all the way up to that very line where extensive excavations are underway right now. And so this site, not just because the harbor is there, but because one of the best preserved of all of the Roman theaters, one that Paul would have looked at, that Jesus would have seen, that Cornelius would have spent a lot of time being entertained in, you know, much of it remains to this day. And we also have this promontory, which is the palace for the successive Herods and or other Roman governors of the time. So as Paul is going to be appearing before Felix and then Festus, likely those events are taking place, we think, right in this area right here. So all of this has been very imposing structures. This is a pool. They had a colonnade, a roof colonnade around it, private swimming pool for Herod. That's who's going to be seeing all of this. You can just have a ton of fun. And then the hippodrome with all of these stands that you see where they did the chariot races and Ben Hur made so famous. The outer wall of that and the stands and everything here was broken down by a tsunami ages ago. But that site, because it has wondrously well-preserved archaeological structures, the theater to this day, they have concerts in it. Here's a backdrop they put in, seats on the floor there that, you know, the expensive seats that you know, they hold their concerts in. Here, again, is the view of the hippodrome, a little bit of the palace. I wanted to emphasize again, it's probably this area or this area that would have been the seat of judgment for the Romans, where those various rulers would have been conducting their trials, and Paul likely was meeting with Felix and Festus as governors. The aqueduct runs for 8 miles to bring water into the city. This is the tail end of it right there. These are pictures I took just last year, just a little under a year ago. I snapped this shot, which shows you that the end of the aqueduct, it too perhaps destroyed by the tsunami, but does not reach all the way to the city now. But you very seldom see, I can't find online, and so I spent a lot of time going in trying to get close-ups of the actual Roman construction. So for 8 miles, they had built actually two structures right next to each other to support a channel that had a rock cover over it to bring enough water for something like 50 to 100,000 people, where there was just absolutely no other source. So they drew all their water from Mount Carmel and another source, but from 8 miles away. And then they just have these endless arches running for 8 miles. The sun was setting when I arrived last year. This was the first place I visited as I drove in after leaving the airport, heading for Galilee. So I got kind of artistic there and took a shot, you know, the sunset through one of those arches. But when you go to Caesarea Maritima, and again, much like Jerusalem, in these two places especially, there is a sense of just overwhelming biblical history. These places are mentioned so often. And brethren, they are always mentioned with absolute accuracy, despite all the skeptics' claims to the contrary. Every time the archaeologist turns over another stave full, there's further confirmation. Every word that you have in your Bible is true. So they've been arguing for ages, you know, you can't trust it, it's not historically accurate, it's all fanciful and all that. And yet, every time, you just give it enough time, and we come to recognize that, of course, it's accurate in its every sense, up to and including descriptions of our very God and heaven itself. So Paul is coming to the end of his journey. He sailed into this port. He's drinking water that comes out of that structure, even though he's going to be in jail here for a couple of years. And in verse 8 of chapter 21, on the next day it says, "We departed, came to this place, Caesarea, and entering the house of Philip the evangelist." Where did we last hear from Philip? Acts chapter 8. Okay, he converts the eunuch. He then is apparently transported somehow miraculously further north, and then Zonas, and then preaches his way up the coast till he comes to Caesarea. been approximately 20 years since Acts chapter 8, and we haven't heard of him in between, so it's at least reasonable to suppose that's where he's been, preaching all this time, raising a family. Now, he's one of the original seven. The seven are from what chapter in Acts? Chapter 6, good for you, this stuff sticks. You know, we had our problem there, logistical problem with the widows. This is, appears to be the same man. And so he is now, in verse 9, a family man. He has four virgin daughters who were prophetesses. And so women did, in fact, prophesy along with the men. This had been foretold in Acts chapter 2. And so we expect this. And these women then, in the time where we still have prophets, and prior to the time that our New Testament is written, are as active, I suppose, as their daddy is in the spread of the word here in this chief Roman city in all of Israel. Now, Herod's got palaces in several different locations, but this is the official governmental seat for all of Israel to the Romans. And so, entering the house of Philip the Evangelist, who was one of the seven, we stayed with him. I think most of you are familiar. Evangelist, it just has to do, the word just means a preacher, someone who brings good news. It is often thought that that inherently requires that he be a constantly traveling man. That, you know, a preacher that would qualify to be called an evangelist would be an itinerant preacher. He's always moving around. This would seem to belie that, assuming, again, that he stayed there these full 20 years. But you really don't need even that rationale. The word doesn't say a thing about having to be constantly moving. You can own a home and be an evangelist. Anybody that is preaching God's good news is an evangelist. And so here's Philip, and he's wearing this title because he's doing this work. And in verse 10, they stayed some days until another prophet, there's a lot of prophetic activity in these times, this one named Agabus, came down from Judea, down, in what sense? Geographically, downhill to the waterline, where Caesarea is. And then, in verse 11, he took Paul's belt, bound his own feet and hands, and said, "This is what the Holy Spirit says. In this way, the Jews at Jerusalem will bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles." So apparently, Agabus is not tying Paul. As I understand the passage, it says he took Paul's belt, but then it says he bound his own hands and feet. And so apparently he sat down and he just did a makeshift, you know, wrapping around and sat down with his hands and his feet tied together there to show that this would be most uncomfortable, it would be utterly restrictive, what Paul was heading into, as illustrated by the belt, and Agabus' body position is going to be really severe. And sure enough, that, of course, is what we'll find. But when the people hear this, well, naturally, they love this man, they don't want this. And so in verse 12, when we had heard this, we, who's still there, we as well as the local residents began begging him not to go up to Jerusalem. And then Paul answered, "What are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart? For I'm ready not only to be bound, but even to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." And since he would not be persuaded, we fell silent, remarking, "The will of the Lord be done." And so here is, you know, the second time, I guess it is, possibly third time, where Paul knows he has to go, the prophets are saying that he has to go, the people appear to be taking this as if it may possibly be a warning that could be avoided. Not so, I need to go, and you're breaking my heart, you know, you're making it harder for me. And so with these words, Paul's fortifying these people who love him so, and preparing himself as well, steeling himself for the trials that lie ahead. So then, in verse 14, well, again, you know, they turn it over to the will of the Lord. The will of the Lord be done. This, of course, is our task as well. The will of the Lord be done. So as I've mentioned so many times, you know, Tuesday nights we meet at the Cafe Yum. We're using the same website, Meetup, that our son, Don, and I, oldest boy, Jesse, you know, videos meet up and holding meetings. He's had four baptisms so far, and we have had four visitors. And typically have dozen to 14 people that come, you know. And so, you know, I wish it was different. But what? The will of the Lord be done. People who are attending, we're still encouraging all of you to come. We're not even quite halfway through the book of Luke yet. We are studying and prospering then on our own and for our own sake. We'll continue to do so until we finish the gospel, and hopefully one of these days, you know, we'll find some visitors too. You do your job, whatever it is, whether or not you see what you think is the desired result or success. By the way, every time I think about this, you know, I am reminded, Brethren, Einstein did not say, okay, that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. In the first place, that is not a definition of insanity in any book. The author of that was decidedly not Einstein. Now, furthermore, brethren, it really makes my blood just kind of boil when Christians start hurling that around, because when it comes to Christianity, while there are certain methods and approaches, we could do away with cafe yum and all of that, the fact of the matter is there a whole lot we could be changing? Truly not. And if people aren't responding, should we quickly misquote Einstein and start changing stuff so we can appeal to folks who are younger or hipper or wealthier or whatever? Should we be worried about those things? What are we looking for? Good hearts. How many good hearts will come to the gospel? Everyone. If they're asking and seeking and knocking, then what? They'll find us. If you don't have a Yellow Pages ad, I was laughing with Don the other day, I didn't even know they were still making that thing. They delivered one to my house the other day. But if you're not on radio, television, all the rest of that, then woe betide the poor soul who wants to become a Christian, because they just never find it. Right? Of course not. But the gospel is absolutely indefeatable. And you can't hide it. If you're doing your job, as we surely are, they'll find us. And so, whether or not you like the way the things are going probably the way they should. And if you start changing the gospel and start trying to, you know, reach out in a wide variety of ways that I've seen churches attempt that really never should have, you know, all you're doing is diluting that gospel for the sake of those who are with good hearts seeking to find it. So we're going to stay that same course. Whether we grow or not, it's the course that God set for us, the pattern that we find in Scripture. And unlike the entire rest of the denominational world, who looks at the New Testament and then says, well, that was all good for back then, but it doesn't apply to us now, times are different and all of that, you know, and so they're happily changing this, that, and every other thing. Well, you know, people don't like a cappella music, and so what do we need? Well, we need a good drummer and a bass player. That kind of stuff. The definition of insanity to keep up with the acapella stuff. No, it's not. It's just the definition of faithfulness. And then, who grants the increase? God grants the increase. So, brother, relax. Don't worry. Be happy. God's in control, not us. It'll go pretty well. The will of the Lord, verse 14, be done. And after these days, we got ready and started on our way up to Jerusalem. So now, who's going to be not on a boat anymore, but on foot with Paul? Luke's still there. We still got that plural we. And some of the disciples from Caesarea also came with us, taking us to Mnason of Cyprus, a disciple of longstanding, with whom we were to lodge. And when we had come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. And now, the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. Does that ring any bells, James and the elders? Where do we hear about James and the elders? Acts chapter... Na, 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 na. 15, the Jerusalem Conference. James is a leader in the church there. When they had the first doctrinal problem in Acts 15, dealt with that. Then James was there, and the apostles as well. So they get to Jerusalem, they come to James, and all the elders were present. Now, in 15 you had the apostles still there. Other apostles are not mentioned this time, so whether or not they are still there, or some number of them is still there, it at least does not say, and perhaps not, perhaps they're in other areas. But James is still there in Jerusalem, just like Philip is still in Caesarea. And now verse 18, Paul went in, the elders are present, 19, and after he greeted them, he began to relate one by one the things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. Now, if you think my sermons run long, I want you to think about sitting down with the elders to relate one by one just the last 3 years of this journey you saw on the screen a little while ago. And then there was the second journey before that. And then there was, the Jerusalem conference before that. And then there was the first journey. And then there was that time, that Barnabas found him over in southeastern Turkey. And so if he's going to relate one by one just the last 4 to 5 years, three of which he spent, in Ephesus, and a riot was started in Acts chapter, Ephesian riot, Acts chapter, okay, you all flunked. Next week we start chapter 1. I know it doesn't come to you. Acts chapter 19. So, how long would it take to just relate that event? And so he's going to sit down and spend a lot of time with them. Everything God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they had heard it, they began, we're in verse 20 now, began glorifying God. And they said to him, "You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law, and they've been told about you, that you are teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses." Now, before we go any farther, let me ask you, have you ever heard me teach that we should forsake Moses? Have you ever heard me teach that we're not under the Mosaic law? Well, sure. Have you ever heard me teach that there's a difference between these two covenants, and that we're under the new and not the old, and that the old shouldn't be carried over into the new? And we learned that in Acts chapter 15 and Galatians and Romans and Hebrews, all books that are dedicated to that proposition. And so we're not keepers of Moses' law. But did I ever teach anybody to forsake it? What have we been doing on Wednesday nights? Isaiah came first, then who'd we look at? Actually, you should say Micah, because Ted took Micah while I was away one night, and then we did Amos. What are we going to start on Wednesday night? This 3 days from now, we're going to look at Hosea. It's going to be just an overview, just a survey, because we've had 66 chapters in Isaiah. We've had 9 in Amos, and 4, I think it is, in Micah, and now there's 14 in Hosea. But we've been working the same time frame, and so I'm going to just do an overview, and it's going to work very, very nicely, because I should be able to wrap that book up before I leave on the 14th of May for Israel. So we're just going to do an overview, a survey of Hosea. But if we're doing all of that, is that because we forsook the Old Covenant or Moses? Well, no. No, we're just not under that covenant, but there's much to be learned from us. None of that is true. And so they say, in verse 21 again, that you're teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children. Have I ever told anybody they should not circumcise their children? Never in my life. Have I ever preached from the pulpit, though, that if you think that's got something to do with salvation, then you shouldn't do it? Well, sure, I've taught that. Circumcision got nothing whatsoever to do with salvation. Gentiles didn't have to be circumcised. We got done with Acts chapter 15. So all these things have an element of truth but can be twisted, and the rumor mongers are going to town on Paul. And thirdly, they say that not to walk according to the customs. Not to walk according to the customs. Brethren, have I ever taught you not to eat bacon? Don't look for soon either. Had some on my Five Guys hamburger just yesterday. Okay, A1 sauce, couple of patties, some bacon. Try it. It's good stuff. Okay? I've never taught anybody not to do that. Okay? But do you have to avoid, you know, pork? Do you have to keep the dietary customs of the old law in order to go to heaven? No. So once again, its words are just being twisted. They're being used against him as a means of resisting the gospel. So in 22, they continue, what then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you've come. Now what are they saying with that sentence? This could get ugly. You know, that's not going to fly very well in Jerusalem if there's this guy here teaching that you should forsake Moses, never circumcise your children, and don't walk according to the customs. Plenty of those customs you could still practice, like circumcision, as long as you know you don't have to. They'll hear you're coming. So in 23, therefore, do this that we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Have we learned from Paul that you can still take vows if you want? Have we learned from Jesus that it'd be wiser not to? Have we seen there's no conflict between the two? Jesus warned, don't take vows. But he didn't forbid it as if it would be a sin if you did. The same holds as in Ecclesiastes. If you're going to keep take a vow, then what? Keep it. That's all. But they're hard to keep. And be wiser just not to make it in the first place. But we got four men and did. So in 24, take them and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses in order that they may shave their heads, and all will know that there's nothing to the things which they've been told about you, but that you yourself also walk orderly. Now here comes the operative phrase, which the Seventh-day Adventists would abandon the whole rest of the New Testament, just then this one phrase, keeping the law. Now brethren, if I am practicing customs that are found in the old law, knowing that they are not required in order to be saved, we learned that in Acts 15, but if I am keeping those customs, even though we're no longer under Moses' law and I don't have to do that to be saved, am I breaking any rules? Is God going to be unhappy with me? No. If I want not to eat bacon for the rest of my life, could I do that? Sure. Can I say to myself, God must have had a reason for those dietary requirements under the old law? Now, I don't know what they were, but it sounds like it's a good idea to me. Now, I know I don't have to do these things anymore because I never was a Jew. I didn't have to do them in the first place. And now we're living under a new covenant. Nobody asked to do them anymore. But I think that I would feel closer both to an understanding of my Bible and to my God if I decided to keep those dietary regulations, because then I would be living that life of those old Jews, and then when I taught about it, most of your Bible is Old Testament anyway, you know, I would have personal experience. Could I do that? Sure. Would I then be keeping the law? Well, I'd be keeping that law regarding those things, but not ever thinking that I had to in order to be saved. So, much like the people that are twisting Paul's words, Seventh-day Adventists have twisted these words and taken them right out of their mouth, you know, and try to suggest that because of this phrase, keeping the law, then you do in fact have to obey the Ten Commandments, the Sabbath. You know, they recommend that you keep the dietary laws, so they're getting farther and farther away from that now. It used to be they were really pretty serious about how you should keep those dietary laws. You don't see that so much anymore. I've always wondered, you know, the Adventists taught that you had to be a vegetarian. And then modern science, of course, has discovered that osteoporosis is a real problem for vegetarians. And that there is a problem because without some input of various kinds of meat, then there are certain body functions where you can't produce minerals or chemicals or whatever they are. I forget now, I've read about it. But you know, you need the balanced meal. Did the Jews eat meat? Yeah, they just didn't eat pork, but they, you know, cattle. And so we've got, you know, an interesting set of ideas here where people look at Scripture and they just really want parts of it from the old law. What was the whole point of Acts 15? Never. If you think you have to be saved, or if you would bind them on anybody. But you're perfectly free to do those things if you want. So, in verse 25, concerning the Gentiles who have believed, we wrote, having decided that they should abstain from meat sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what is strangled, and from fornication. Does that sound familiar? Acts chapter 15. This is the letter that was the result of that meeting. So we taught those things. So in 26, Paul took them in, and the next day, purifying himself along with them. Purifying himself along with them according to what direction? The Old Testament law of Moses. They went ahead and did it. You have to do that to be saved? No. Can you do that if you want? Sure. So they went into the temple. Can you go into the temple if you're a Christian, or are you now forbidden? Well, you can go in the temple. If giving notice of the completion of the days of purification until the sacrifice was offered for each one of them. So whatever the vows were, whatever the particular requirements were, Paul went in and he did it. Just like he was a fine, faithful Jew the way he'd been all of his life. And he violated no rules regarding Christianity. He bound no part of the Old Testament upon anybody. And he did it for exactly the same reason that he had Timothy circumcised. Which was why? In order to be saved? No. In order to get along with people who thought you had to do it to be saved. They knew you didn't. But if we just would do this thing, we'll have more opportunity to work with these people so we can teach them they don't have to do it, but can if they want. And so those distinctions, you know, are in several places in Scripture. So he went ahead. He's already taken one vow. Now he's going to go and do this purification with these guys. And 27, it was 7 days. When the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up the multitude and lay hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people." Brethren, have I ever preached against any Jew? No. Particularly because there aren't any today that you could possibly identify, so how can I do that? But, you know, and besides, he's even brought Greeks into the temple. Had he done that? Oh, that's a pure lie. And he's defiled this holy place. Had he done that? No, it's a total lie. Now, whether or not these guys had pursued Paul like the Thessalonians did to Berea, we don't know. I don't know why they were there. But these Jews from Asia, where's Ephesus? Well, it's in Asia. Where's Troas? Asia. Where's Colossae? Miletus? They're all in Asia. Seven churches, the Revelation, are the seven churches of Asia. And so Paul's been through, you know, most of those places. He hadn't been to all of them, but he's going through this region, and these people, they're still Jews. They didn't convert. So Paul's got them a problem. These guys, whether they're pursuing him or not, they're in town. By the way, Paul's in a hurry to get here for what? He wanted to get there for that Passover. Well, what would those Jews be there for? Exactly the same reason. So they may have come with a vengeance, you know, seeking after Paul, and they have just found him there by coincidence. I do not know, but they lied through their teeth. And this because, in 29, they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian in the city with him. And they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. Well, I once baptized a man who was a murderer. What does that mean? About my character, about whether or not I conspired to commit murder or been involved in a murder. What does that say? Nothing in the world. So I'm a Trophimus. Well, fine. Did you see Trophimus in the temple? Well, no. But it didn't matter. Never does matter, brethren, if you don't want to open your heart to the Lord. Then any excuse is as good as another. So they made it up. Trophimus the Ephesian was in the city, but he wasn't in the temple, and they supposed that Paul had brought him in. Well, that supposition is incorrect. In 30, all the city was aroused. People rushed again, taking hold of Paul, dragged him out of the temple. Immediately the doors were shut. So in the end, how well did this plan turn out? Well, all you got to do is do this, you know, they'll see you doing it, and then they'll say, oh, well, there's nothing to what everybody's saying then, and everybody, you know, accept you. Did it work? Well, it had exactly the opposite effect. And so, again, you know, Paul's original lights, I think, were probably more correct. You know, they don't need to do this, but, you know, they persuaded him, and now it's just bad. The city's aroused, people rush together to lay hold of Paul and drag him out of the temple, and then the doors were shut. Why did they shut the doors on the temple? Because now, had Trophimus been in there, by their ideas, it would have been defiled. It's going to have to go through a cleansing process, you know, and this is a major upset for them thinking these things. And so, in 31, while they were seeking to kill him, a report came up to the commander of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. At once, he took along soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the commander of the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Have you stopped beating your what? Okay. When you use that phrase, what does that mean? What does that imply about the beating? It's been going on for quite a while. It's a sustained kind of thing. Paul is really taking that abuse now that he'd been warned was coming his way, but which he steeled himself to accept. So in 33, commander came up, took hold of him, ordered him to be bound with two chains, and began asking him who he was and what he had done. If the whole city's in an uproar, my life's on the line now, because if Jerusalem gets out of hand, I'm charged with its peace. You know, I'm going to be in trouble with the emperor. That's going to be bad for me. What are you doing? So in 34, among the crowd, some were shouting one thing and some another, and when he could not find out the facts on account of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. Now, there's a lot of ways this is translated. There's a lot of discussion about where exactly this was. And I'll show you some pictures in just a second. But when he got to the stairs, there's another clue. It so happened that he was carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the mob, not to mention what else. He's been beaten, probably to a bloody pulp, and he's wearing two chains. Paul is not exactly, you know, a basketball star in the condition he's in right now. So they carried him. You know, the multitude of the people in 36 kept falling behind, crying out, "Away with him!" Do they mean put him in a jail cell? No, they're trying to kill him, and they're trying to incite everybody else to just murder him. So in 37, as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I say something to you?" And the commander said, "Do you know Greek? Then you're not the Egyptian who some time ago stirred up a revolt and led 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" They had a problem with some guy. And Paul said, "I'm a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city, and I beg you, allow me to speak to the people." And when he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs, motioned to the people with his hand, and when there was a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, saying what Ted will tell you next week. Okay, that's the natural break, and time's up anyway. So I'll just leave you with this thought if you come back to the screen. Just last year, since I spent 2 weeks living in Jerusalem itself, just on my own, and a quarter of a mile from the Temple Mount, I just spent a lot of time every day, hours and hours and hours, just wandering the city. And so this is the Temple Mount itself. And you're looking at the likely location for that barracks. Now, these are Muslim structures that have existed for a long time, but certainly were not there during the time of Paul. And I'm, as you can see, walking down this cobblestone walkway or pavement, there's another set of buildings that you can barely see. I got in a photo there. But this is the corner of the Temple Mount. It is the northwest corner inside the enclosure for the Temple Mount. And so I walked in there because I wanted to see this area. We're really pretty sure that when you get down into this corner, you can see that all of the construction is built on an inclined bedrock, which it appears was just like that at the time. And so the best understanding of the lay of the land and what Josephus and other eyewitnesses say about it is that this barracks was in the place where this structure is right now. And in this corner, there was a staircase that allowed the Roman soldiers to have immediate access to the Temple Mount in the event of just such a problem as this. Now, I don't know if Paul had managed to get out of the temple and off the Temple Mount. Maybe he did. If he did, there was another set of stairs on just the other side of the wall right here that came up into this same area. I think he was on the Temple Mount. He would have been right here. So here are these people. It's immediately adjacent to the temple itself. And there's this structure, a little bit close up, you can see that even as today, you have buildings on top of this bedrock. But it can't be, it's like six stories high. So that you could, from a staircase, as you got up way up there, you know, to go into this barracks, you could stand on that staircase and look out into this courtyard. So here's the corridor back here, and you would be looking out at an area where, I guess, pretty easily you could put 5,000 to 10,000 people. So Paul has the perfect location. Walls to his back, standing on stairs, surrounded by soldiers, wearing the irons, you know, and beaten to a pulp, he speaks what you'll hear in chapter 22 next week. He will give his first defense in Jerusalem in keeping with the prophecies of Agabus and others. Okay, that's our time. Thank you.